We are in the midst of our series going through 1 and 2 Samuel. Primary character in the books of Samuel is David. There are two moments in David's life that would go in the category of his most famous or infamous moments. First moment is David and Goliath. The second is David and Bathsheba. David and Bathsheba, that story is in chapter 11 of 2 Samuel. That's where we're going to be this morning. And I need to warn you up front. This morning is going to be a little raw. So raw that we always keep our 4th through 6th graders in here on the first Sunday of the month. We sent a letter out to the families, go, hey, it's going to be raw. And let the families decide best way to do that in their context. It's going to be raw because we're going to be talking about sin. We're going to be talking about David's sin. And we're going to be talking about our sin. And some of you might go, well, what about Bathsheba's sin? We'll come back to that question in a few moments. We're going to dive into the 11th chapter this morning. In the spring, at the time when the kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained in Jerusalem. We need to stop right here because there's an awful lot that's already happening that we can't just gloss over. I hope you notice this, what it says. At the time when the kings go off the war, David remained in Jerusalem. Question, who's the king? David. According to this, where is he supposed to be? He's supposed to be at war. He's supposed to be out fighting. Has it ever occurred to you that if David had been where he was supposed to be, doing what he was supposed to do, when he was supposed to do it, the rest of chapter 11 wouldn't have happened? If David would have been where he was supposed to be, doing what he was supposed to do, all the rest of the story of David and Bathsheba wouldn't have happened. When we are where we're supposed to be, doing what we're supposed to be doing, we're far less likely to fall into temptation. To give in to temptation. If you are familiar with recovery ministries like AA or NA, you're probably familiar with the acronym HALT. The acronym HALT stands for Hungry, Angry, Lonely, Tired. The thinking goes this way. They have identified that if somebody is hungry or angry or lonely or tired, they are far more susceptible to relapsing. When somebody is hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, their decision-making is compromised. Which takes us right back to David. He's not where he should be, doing what he's supposed to be doing. He's not in a healthy place, and so his decision-making is compromised. So the question goes out to you. Are you in a healthy place? If you're not in a healthy place, chances are your ability to make decisions is being somewhat compromised. David was not in a healthy place. He wasn't where he was supposed to be, doing what he was supposed to be doing. How about you? How about me? Story continues. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "She is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, and the wife of Uriah the Hittite." Then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. Now she was purifying herself from her monthly uncleanness. Then she went back home. The woman sent word to David saying, "I am pregnant." There's so much going on in these three verses. From the roof, he saw a beautiful woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. And some of us go, aha, there it is. Bathsheba is being a temptress, parading naked on a rooftop. She is obviously aware that the king is in the palace and the king is able to see her. She is tempting him. She is luring the king. Really? Is that our conclusion about what's happening here? Did you already forget the part where it said David sent messengers to get her? It's important to notice something here. The word sent is the same Hebrew word that you saw in verse 1 when it says that David sent Joab. David is commander-in-chief, and he sent his lieutenant, his military leader. Let me ask you this question. Did Joab have a choice when the commander-in-chief told his lieutenant to go? Joab didn't have a choice when the king sent. What makes you think Bathsheba did? If you go to the very end of chapter 11, it concludes this way. It says, what David did displeased the Lord. Nowhere in the 11th chapter do you see that language applied to Bathsheba. Our preoccupation with wanting to place some of the blame on Bathsheba reveals an ugliness in us. We're quick to shift the blame or the attention away from the one that has done what is wrong. But we say, oh, but Bathsheba, she should have been more careful. Bathsheba, she should have been more modest. Is there a time and a place to talk about modesty? To talk about the fact that we have influence on the people around us? Certainly, there is a time to talk about modesty. But we need to be very clear about something here. There is plenty of evidence that the bath that Bathsheba is taking is a religious ritual, not a sensuous bubble bath. When we look at this story, we are reminded, if we look closely, Bathsheba is not being a temptress here. If anything, it's pointing out that she is a devout follower of Yahweh because she's doing the things that Yahweh told women to do. She's not being the temptress here. Our preoccupation with the perception that she lacked modesty steals our attention from what's really going on in chapter 11 of 2 Samuel. And it reveals something about our hearts and our souls. Why is it that we are more prone to defend David than to advocate for Bathsheba? In Proverbs, we read this. Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, for the rights of all who are destitute. Speak up and judge fairly. Defend the rights of the poor and needy. When we are more prone to defend the person abusing power than the rights of the abused, when we don't speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, whose voices have been marginalized and or silenced, when we do not speak up for the rights of the destitute, the poor, and the needy, we reinforce an evil that tries to convince the abused that they deserve what they got. Mm. Yesterday morning, I was in a video conference call with someone from Washington and someone in London. And the young woman, one of the people in the conversation, a longtime friend of mine, I was sharing with them what I was going to be talking about this morning. And she said, you know, Mike, as a child in church, I remember being taught in Sunday school the David and Bathsheba story. And what I took from the lesson was, Bathsheba was dirty, and so am I. That's the lesson a 7-year-old girl took. Bathsheba's dirty. So am I, then. What is taking place in the 11th chapter is an abuse of power And I would love for it just to be here, but it's not. It goes throughout the entire chapter. It's an abuse of power. And watch this. What happens when you take the when you take abuse of power and add to it sex? What you have are the ingredients of rape. Rape is an abuse of power. You might think, well, Mike, you're being too extreme with this. And yes, it is extreme. And shame on us when we think it's something less than extreme. Mm-hmm. And it's far too common. Mm-hmm. 1 in 4 women and 1 out of 6 men are sexually abused in their lifetime, and that number is tragically incorrect. Because studies show that only about 27 people that are sexually assaulted actually report it. Maybe out of fear, maybe out of shame, doesn't matter. Only about 1/4 of the people that are sexually assaulted report it. So that initial statistic is actually low. 1 out of 10 rape cases, the victim knows the attacker. 13.3% of college women say they have been forced to have sex in a dating situation. Among developmentally disabled adults, and every time I read this one, among developmentally disabled adults, up to 83% of females and 32% of males are victims of sexual violence. 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 7 boys will be sexually assaulted by the time they reach 18. More than 4 children die each day because of child abuse. You look at those numbers and you go, what can I do? It seems completely overwhelming. Like, what can I do? A couple suggestions for us. When a person tells you what they're experiencing or have experienced, listen. I'm learning this. I'm learning this. I was recently speaking with a dear friend of mine who has her own Bathsheba story. And as she's telling me part of her story, she's welling up with tears, and everything inside of me wanted to leap up from my chair and give her this giant hug and remind her that she is loved and what was done to her was not okay, and that Jesus loves her and is not done with her, and God is going to take a past that cannot be changed and transform it into a life that will be forever. I wanted every part of me to jump up and hug her. And I'm so glad I did not, because that would have been the absolute wrong thing to do. For a 6'2" bald guy to jump up and grab this person who has a Bathsheba story. My job in that moment was to listen. Mm-hmm. And listen. And not try to fix. Mm-hmm. And not try to give advice. Or not try to diffuse a situation with some Hallmark platitudes. Mm-hmm. We need to listen. God gave you 2 ears, 1 mouth. You should listen twice as much as you talk. But when you do talk, I'd encourage this. Ask the question, what don't I understand? Mm-hmm. What don't I understand? I'm finding myself asking this a lot. What don't I understand? I hope I'm smart enough to know I'm not smart enough. And the things I understand, it's a much smaller number than the things I don't understand. And will we have the courage and humility to ask that question and listen? I love how the contemporary English version translates this proverb. Fools have no desire to learn. They would much rather give their own opinion. It's stupid and embarrassing to give an answer before you listen.
That's great.
Our job as followers of Jesus to listen to people's stories. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to say something, say, what don't I know? What don't I understand? And then once we begin to understand something, when you learn, it's time to speak up. Not to that person, but speak up when we see injustice. I recently heard somebody say this, when you see injustice, speak up. Even if it's at cost to yourself, that's what believers do. And by the way, when it says at cost to yourself, I almost guarantee the cost will not come from outside the church. It will come from inside the church. When you begin to learn what you don't know. And you begin to see injustice and abuse of power, and you begin to speak up, chances are it's going to come from the church, not outside the church, where you start getting challenged as people get into it with you. Just fair warning there. One of the things that we can do as followers of Jesus is be proactive for those that have been objectified and marginalized. For all those that have suffered under individuals that have abused their power. And speak up. Not because those that have been marginalized don't have a voice. Oh, they have a voice. But too often those voices have been drowned out, have been discarded. Will this solve the problem? If we do these things on the screen, will this solve the problem of abuse of power in our community, our neighborhoods, in our world? No, it will not. But will it move us towards being part of the solution rather than a silent contributor to the perpetuation, the contribution, continuation, and preservation of the problem? Yes. There's a woman I've known for years, and she is one of the sharpest Old Testament minds that I know. When I study difficult passages in the Old Testament, I regularly call her. And I ask her, how do you read this? And so I called her this past week, and we talked about 45 minutes on the phone. And she's kind of walking me through some of her observations in this passage. And then she told me about an experience she had teaching this chapter. And when she told me her experience, I go, can you please send me what you just said? So she sent me this email. Let me read it to you. After the Bible study, I divided the participants into small groups and had them discuss the five questions. Two of the groups happened to have only one man in each. After the small group discussion was over and the Bible study had ended, separately, both men came up and told me of their experience. In discussing the question, have you ever been in a situation where you felt trapped by the privilege of power that others have over you? Is it difficult for you to imagine a situation like Bathsheba? Neither man could come up with an example when they felt trapped by power. And yet everyone at their table had a story to tell. The men were flabbergasted how every woman at their table knew what it was like to be trapped by power. It was an eye-opening experience for both men. One was in his 70s. The other was in his 30s. So where do you start? We have those three suggestions up there of things to do, but where do you start? Ask your wife this question. Ask your daughter this question. Ask your mom this question. Ask your sister this question. And then listen. Maybe respond with, what don't I understand? They might not be willing or able to share. And we need to be okay with that. It's their story to tell, if and when they're ready to tell it. We get to be patient. Remember back in verse 1? Where was David supposed to be? He was supposed to be fighting. Could it be that we're supposed to be fighting? Could it be that we're supposed to be fighting against the abuse of power and fighting for the abused, marginalized, and neglected? Maybe we're supposed to be fighting, and instead we've been sending other people off to do the fighting for us. Yeah. Verse 3 said, David sent someone to find out about her. The man, I love this, the man, said she is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Okay, again, loaded verse here. Chuck Swindoll points out here that normally in Israel, they would give the genealogy of a person without relation to the mate. So when you're asking about someone, the normal practice goes, well, this person was, their parents were this person, the grandparent was this person. They usually wouldn't point out who they're married to. So what do you have right here? You've got the man trying to give some warning and advice to David. Mm-hmm. Hey, who is this person? It's Bathsheba, so-and-so's daughter, and Uriah's wife. She's married. Someone tried to give him some help. He didn't take it. Do you have anyone in your life that speaks truth into your life, that is able to alert you to some blind spots in your life? Do you have anyone like that? Follow-up question, do you listen to them? I mean, because it's one thing to have somebody that speaks truth into your life, but if you're not willing to listen to them, it's not doing you a whole lot of good. In the movie Pinocchio, Pinocchio is given a conscience. And the conscience is played by Jiminy Cricket. But little old wooden head doesn't understand what a conscience is. So he goes, what's a conscience? I've always loved Jiminy Cricket's response. He says, what's a conscience? I'll tell you. A conscience is that still small voice people won't listen to. That's just the trouble with the world today. What's a conscience? It's that still small voice that people won't listen to. I've often described the Holy Spirit this way. Mm-hmm. Looking for a voice that's going to speak truth into our lives. What are the roles of the Spirit? Spirit's that strong, still voice that we just don't pay any attention to. In fact, we tend to treat the Holy Spirit like the Spirit is our servant in our personal palace. Oh, we ask the servant for instruction, for guidance, for information, but when the servant doesn't give us the answer that we want, that meets our needs, our desires, we dismiss the servant like David dismissed the man. Do you have someone in your life that speaks truth and guidance to you? Do you listen? She was purifying herself from her monthly uncleanness. I am pregnant. What this is communicating right here is that there is physical proof that there's no way that the child in her could come from Uriah. There's the physical evidence. Watch what happens next. So David sent this word to Joab, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent him to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked him how Joab was, how the soldiers were, and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. At this moment, David's not concerned at all about the hygiene of Uriah's toes. That's not what's happening here. You've got a euphemism here. Go home to your beautiful wife. Wash your feet. I'm going to leave it there. Mm-hmm. He's not telling him to get soap and water onto his toes. Go home. Wash your feet. You've been away from your wife for a long time. So Uriah left the palace, and a gift from the king was sent after him. But Uriah slept at the entrance of the palace with his master's servants and did not go down to his house. David was told Uriah did not go home. So he asked Uriah, haven't you just come from a military campaign? Why don't you go home and wash your feet? Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my commander Joab and my Lord's men are camped in the open country. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and make love to my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing. Then David said to him, stay here one more day, and tomorrow I will send you back. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. At David's invitation, he ate and drank with him, and David made him drunk. But in the evening, Uriah went out to sleep on his mat among his servants. He did not go home and wash his feet. So far in the books of Samuel, you have two characters that are being compared to one another. You've got King Saul being compared with King David. A huge comparison going on in 1 and 2 Samuel. But when you get to the 11th chapter of 2 Samuel, the comparison changes. It's no longer David and Saul. Now it's David and Uriah. There's a huge comparison that's happening right here. David T. Arnold writes that the great irony of our text is that this convert of foreign ancestry is more righteous than the Israelite king. Whew. This convert of foreign ancestry, he's a Hittite, he's not an Israelite, is more righteous than the Israelite king. Well, let's see if we agree with Bill T. Arnold. So we're going to do a quick Deuteronomy test. I'll grab a couple of verses out of Deuteronomy, see how our two contestants do. We have Uriah, we have David. In chapter 19 of Deuteronomy, it says that, or chapter 23 of Deuteronomy, it requires soldiers on active duty to abstain from sexual activity. How did Uriah do? He passed. All right, so far Uriah's passing the Deuteronomy test. Now wait a second, God says we're not supposed to do this. I'm not doing it. Well, how did David do in the Deuteronomy test? Because in Deuteronomy chapter 5, you've got the Ten Commandments. And in chapter 11 of 2 Samuel, David breaks at least three of the commandments. Shalt not covet your wife, or your neighbor's wife. Shalt not commit adultery. You shalt not murder. At least three of the Ten Commandments he discards in one chapter. I could argue a few more probably being discarded as well. When it comes to obedience, we like to pick and choose what we're going to obey. Yes, we understand that God is calling us to a great number of things, but we're going to pick and choose what is most comfortable for us. So we like to pick and choose how we're going to be obedient, and then we are prone to justify our disobedience. Is this what Uriah did? He could have very easily gotten into justification mode, couldn't he? Am I really on active duty right now? And by the way, the king has given me a pass. He could have slipped right into justification mode, but he didn't. Are we more like Uriah or more like David? Do we remain obedient, or do we justify our disobedience? Are we prone to pick and choose that which we want to obey and then justify it later? At this point, David realizes that his original plan to cover up his sin isn't working, so he changed tactics. Sends Uriah back to the front, along with a message. Who carries the message to Joab? Uriah does, not knowing what's inside of it. This is what's inside of it. To Joab, David says, put Uriah out in front where the fighting is fiercest, then withdraw from him so he will be struck down and die. And it's exactly what happens. This is not a casualty of war. This is a murder. Mm-hmm. It's different. David put a hit out on Uriah. Mm-hmm. There's no other way to look at that. When Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. After the time of mourning was over, David had her brought to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing David had done displeased the Lord. How does someone end up in such an evil place? go from a man after God's own heart to a murderer and an adulterer? Eugene Peterson writes, how does such sin happen? As with most sins, gradually and unobtrusively. David didn't just wake up at the beginning of chapter 11 and flip a switch. In fact, if you go back to Deuteronomy, God says in Deuteronomy that there will come a time when Israel will have a king. And your future king is to not do three things. They are not to multiply horses. They are not to multiply silver and gold for themselves. And they are not to have multiple wives. They're not to multiply horses. In other words, put all of their hope in their military. They're not to multiply their silver and gold. Don't put your hope in your wealth. And don't multiply your wives. David didn't do two of them, but that last one, he started to do a long time before chapter 11. Bathsheba is not his first wife, her second wife, his third wife. Maybe fourth wife? And concubines as well. When we become comfortable with our sin, when we become comfortable in justifying our sin, we open ourselves up to become tragically forgetful. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in his book Temptation, says this: in our members there is a slumbering inclination toward desire which is both sudden and fierce. With irresistible power, desire seizes mastery of the flesh. All at once, a secret smoldering fire is kindled. The flesh burns and is in flames. It makes no difference whether it is a sexual desire or ambition or vanity or desire for revenge or love of fame and power or greed for money. At this moment, God is quite unreal to us. He loses all reality, and the only desire for a creature is real. The only reality is the devil. Satan does not here fill us with hatred of God, but with forgetfulness of God. How comfortable have you become with your sin? How quick are you to justify your disobedience? Do you realize that our capacity to become forgetful of God is not any different from that of David's? This morning, he is compromised. We disregard the voices of people that are hoping to guide us and the whisper of the Holy Spirit, and we treat the Spirit sometimes like a hired servant. Sometimes we're like David in that we grow increasingly forgetful or indifferent towards God. For some of us, that's why this morning has been hard. For others of us, we feel a newly discovered sense of shame and remorse at our silent complicity to the suffering of the countless Bathshebas in our world. And we're intimidated and afraid of entering into relationships where we are called to listen and ask, what don't we understand? And we're paralyzed by our fear. And still others are quick to identify with Bathsheba. And the telling of this story this morning and the abuse of power that David exhibits has ripped open scars. Talking with a friend, and I was saying at this point in the sermon, to those of you that readily identify with Bathsheba, I don't know what to say. Because it hasn't been my story. As I was sharing this with my friend, I said, I don't know what to say. And she said to me, maybe you're not supposed to say anything. And I looked at her and go, would you be willing to say something? Because is far more appropriate for it to come from you than from me. I asked her to write something, and so this is what she writes to all of you that share in a Bathsheba story. Come to me, little one. You are not small to me. I am sorry for the way they treated you. Your bones are breaking from the stones they threw against your skin. I'm sorry for the way they treated you. They cut you deep to the bone. They made a mess of you and expect you to clean it up. I'm sorry for the way they treated you. I'm sorry they tried to drown you. Don't be ashamed, my love. It's not your fault. You don't need to hide your blood from me. I'm sorry for the way they treated you. You are safe here with me, little one. This pain will not last forever. There is hope and healing for you because you are not small to me. I am sorry for the way they have treated you. On most Sunday mornings, our preference is to have a service that goes something like this. That's what we want. We want the resolution. That's what we want. But this morning, we're not getting the last two claps. Now, we proclaimed earlier in the morning that because of the work of Jesus Christ, there is forgiveness for all and new life for all. And we hold to that truth diligently. And next week, Pastor Chris is preaching. He's preaching at chapter 12, and he's preaching out of Psalm 51, where you get to see the confession and the repentance and the forgiveness. We get the last two. But too often we run to the last two claps and we don't sit in the hard places. Mm-hmm. We usually do the offering at the end, and the more we talked about it, I said, no way. Because this morning is a... And don't run to the last two claps. Don't run there.